Kia ora koutou. Good morning. Thank you, sir. It's good to be with you again. My name's Chris, unless I've done something wrong, in which case my name is Christopher, which I do get quite a lot. We're continuing our series in the book of Esther this morning, so if you have a Bible and you want to get ready for that, turn to chapter 5, because that's where we are today. But before we dive into that, I do want to test you first by asking you, what is the greatest Star Wars movie of all time? New Hope, not bad. Empire Strikes Back would be acceptable. The correct answer is Rogue One from 2016. If you don't know this movie, it's about a small group of rebels who risk their lives against the odds to try and steal the plans to the Death Star in order to overthrow the evil Empire, not really knowing how they're going to do it, willing to accept they might die to do it, in order to get the Death Star plans into the hand of Princess Leia in 1977. And movies are full of this kind of theme of sacrificial heroes, the small guys willing to stand up against the evil overlords to overthrow them, willing to give their lives for it, but not really knowing what they're going to do or how it's going to play out. And of course, the greatest work of fiction in the 20th century was Lord of the Rings, written by J.R.R. Tolkien, the father of modern fantasy. I loved these books growing up. I devoured them as a child. And I remember in the late 90s when I heard they were making movies of Lord of the Rings, I was equal parts skeptical and excited. So I did what any true nerd would do on the first day the films came out, is I went with my best mate to see it twice on the day it came out, the first time to tear it apart and the second time to enjoy it. But Lord of the Rings also has this theme in it of these small guys, especially the hobbits, who don't really know how they can take on the evil Sauron's empire, but willing to go on this journey to take the ring into Mordor against all odds, willing to give their lives in order to overthrow the evil empire. Also in Lord of the Rings, there's this key moment. I'm assuming that Lord of the Rings isn't spoilers at this point. Let's just get past that. There's this key moment where Gandalf returns from the dead and comes back as Gandalf the White. And when he returns to the Fellowship, he says this key line when he meets Aragorn and the others, and he says, "I come back to you now at the turn of the tide." So in this grand story, this key moment has happened where Gandalf has come back, and even though it seems like Sauron's forces are at their peak and they're about to siege Minas Tirith and there seems like there's no hope for anyone and the Fellowship is splintered, Gandalf comes back and says, now is the turn of the tide. It might seem like the enemy has won, but actually now the tide has turned and is coming back in. And the characters in the story, they don't know how it's going to get from out there to back in here, but the key moment has happened, and so the trajectory of the story has changed, the tide has turned, because Gandalf has come. Now, literature is safe because you're in the hands of an author or a director who is sovereign over the destiny of the characters. It feels safe when you can trust the author, right? And even in like Pride and Prejudice, for example, when Elizabeth rejects Mr. Darcy's proposal and they say rude things about each other, you know it's fine. It's all going to work out because it's Jane Austen and there are rules to these things. Yeah, the characters in the moment don't know how it's going to play out. But as a reader looking in, you're in the safe hands of the author. You can trust the author. It's not the same when you're one of the characters in the story. And it's not real life either. Is it? Or is it real life? Is life safe? Like, do you know how this is going to end? Because I say to you today, as Christians, we can trust the author of our life. We don't know how it's going to work out, but he does. And we can trust him because the end is certain. I've enjoyed reading the book of Esther recently. A couple of months ago, I sat down to read it from beginning to end. I don't think I've actually done that before in my life. I think I've just come across it in sections when you do Bible reading plans. But I'd encourage you, if you haven't done it yet, to read Esther from beginning to end, because it's a great narrative. It's fantastic. It's got tension, drama, foreshadowing, political intrigue, partying and violence. And it is an expertly crafted narrative, but it's also historical events, with God as the author, orchestrating things behind the scenes. And today we get to chapter 5, which is the middle of the story, the pivot point. So the setup has been complete over the last 4 chapters, and it's now time for action. This is the turning of the tide. This is the key moment where the outcome of the story changes. And in the chapter today, Esther takes the plunge, and the audience holds their breath. After playing it safe for the first four chapters, arguably just in survival mode for Esther, now she jumps off the cliff. Will her parachute open? So if you have a Bible, turn to chapter 5. It will be on the screen as well. Just by way of a little bit of context before we start reading this chapter, in the previous chapter, we heard a couple of weeks ago, the Jewish people are threatened with genocide. A decree has been issued throughout the Persian Empire, orchestrated by Haman, who's the chief advisor to the king, but enabled by the absent king, who seems to only care about conquests, lavish feasts, and drinking. But through God's providence in horrific circumstances, Esther, a Jewish girl, finds herself as queen, in a position to maybe do something about it, but still vulnerable. She knows she could get killed. It is made clear in the previous chapter that if she goes into the presence of the king without being invited, her life is forfeit. And she also knows the queen she replaced previously was cast out on a whim, and the king has plenty more queens available to him where they both came from. But she's in a position of influence, and encouraged by her uncle Mordecai, it's time to act on behalf of the Jewish people. So she asks the nation to fast for her for 3 days, and then comes the key moment when we hold our breath, and this could all end very quickly. Esther chapter 5. Oops, there you go. Thank you. We just go back to the previous one. I think we both skipped at the same time there. Thank you. On the third day, Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace in front of the king's quarters while the king was sitting on his royal throne inside the throne room opposite the entrance to the palace. And when the king saw Queen Esther standing in the court, she won favor in his sight. And he held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand. Then Esther approached and touched the tip of the scepter. And the king said to her, "What is it, Queen Esther? What is your request? It shall be given you, even to half my kingdom." And Esther said, "If it please the king, let the king and Haman come today to a feast that I have prepared for the king." Then the king said, "Bring Haman quickly, so that we may do as Esther has asked." So the king and Haman came to the feast that Esther had prepared. And as they were drinking wine after the feast, the king said to Esther, "What is your wish? It shall be granted you. And what is your request? Even to the half of my kingdom it shall be fulfilled." Then Esther answered, "My wish and my request is, if I have found favor in the sight of the king, and if it please the king to grant my wish and fulfill my request, let the king and Haman come to the feast that I will prepare for them, and tomorrow I will do as the king has said." This chapter is helpfully divided into two halves for us, and we're going to take them a half at a time this morning. This first half focusing on Esther, and then the second half focusing on Haman and comparing their two approaches. We read at the beginning, this is the third day, so the Jewish nation has been praying for Esther and for this situation for 3 days, and now it's time to take action. This action takes place in the palace of Susa, which is a very well-preserved and excavated archaeological site in southern Iran. The palace is these walls in the foreground here. You can see the layout of the palace, the base of the walls. And the aerial shot shows you how vast it is, this layout of grid of the foundations of the palace in Susa. And the action that we're looking at today is believed to take place here. So this is the throne room here. Archaeologists have found what they believe to be the base of the throne that sat in that room. And the inner court is here. So Esther would have come into this area here and been seen by the king and then invited to approach when he raised his scepter to her. That's the bit, the entering the court here into the presence of the king without being invited. That's the thing that she should have been killed for. But she's not executed. And instead, King Xerxes extends her the scepter of his favor, meaning that she's acceptable in his presence and she can approach. And she accepts that by touching the end of the scepter in humility, gratefully accepting his favor. And Esther has won favor up to this point, and it continues. You see, God is sovereign over how people respond to you. Whether people accept you or reject you in any one moment, you can't control what others think of you, what they say about you, but you can trust the God who knows how to care for his children. And the thing that confuses me about this story is once Esther's there, why doesn't she just spit it out? Why doesn't she just say, "Do you know that my people are going to all be killed on a certain date that's been orchestrated by Haman?" But she doesn't. And the Bible doesn't tell us why. And this fascinates me. Maybe it's as simple as, if you want the king to do something, get him drunk. It's effective, if not particularly moral or ethical. Maybe that's why she invites him to a feast. And in fact, she invites him to two feasts, and in this chapter, she doesn't actually get to the point at all. You're going to have to come back next time to find out what actually happens when she actually tackles this thing head on. But she arranges two feasts. Why was that? Did she intend to confront him then and there, but then chickened out of it, out of fear, and said, oh, let me invite you to a feast? Or did she have a clever plan all along? And why invite Haman? Did she plan to call him out directly? Or was she trying to manipulate him and put him into a corner? The Bible doesn't tell us whether this was a clever, shrewd plan or whether she was making it up as she went along. And maybe she sensed the time wasn't right. But whatever happens, she's walking a very narrow tightrope here. This is a precarious position that she finds herself in. And if it was me, I wouldn't have slept. The dragging it out for one day to the next day would have killed me. And I just want to tackle it and got it over with. But this is a political game of intrigue. And I think King Xerxes would have been teased by this. I think this is appealing to his interest, flattering his ego, and I think he's enjoying the game for now. But Esther also knows how fickle he is and that he could turn at any moment, and how quickly he turned on his previous queen and effectively ended her life. But whatever Esther's intentions were, God is at work behind the scenes. God's sovereign hand is working through her willingness to act, and his providence is achieving his purposes, because this is how our God works. And when I was reading this story, I was reminded of this verse in Matthew. Jesus is speaking to his disciples, and he's about to send them out into the world to minister for him. And he says, behold, I am sending you out as sheep in the midst of wolves, so be wise as serpents and innocent as doves. So what he's saying to his disciples is, I'm sending you out into the world, and it is dangerous. You're not going to be received with a friendly welcome everywhere you go. So don't be naive. Be wise as serpents, maybe be shrewd in how you deal with the world, but also maintain your humility and your gentleness and your purity like a dove. And whether it was intentional or on the fly, I think that's how Esther approached it. She was not naive in approaching the king. She knew exactly what situation she was in, but she did so with wisdom and with humility. And I was thinking a lot about what it means to be a Christian in the world today. In New Zealand, we don't know open oppression against Christians in this country today, but subtle suppression is in the air around us every day, constantly. And we have to decide how and when to stand up for Christ. In the previous chapter, Mordecai says to Esther, who knows, maybe for such a time as this, you've been put in this position so that you can act. And before we deal with that, let me just say this. So often as Christians, I think we look for those big heroic moments where we see a healing or we see someone saved, and that's what we're aiming for all the time. And those matter. But for such a time as this does not just mean one action. It means ongoing influence day by day, a steady presence in the place where God has put you. And those big moments, those glorious moments, they arise from a vast landscape of faithfulness over time, of doing the ordinary things day in, day out. Don't despise the small things. It's okay to quietly live out your life knowing that by being faithful, you are influencing the people around you. But there may come a time when you have to make a stand. And here I'm not talking about standing for poverty or standing against slavery or alleviating injustice, which are all fantastic and must be done, but the world would applaud those. I'm talking about making a stand for Christ, about declaring yourself a man or a woman of God, and setting yourself apart from the modern world. And if you have to do that, count the cost. Don't be naive, because it could cost you. Esther kept her heritage hidden through this story. She didn't reveal to the king that she was a Jew. And I feel this challenge. The Bible doesn't tell us that Esther was right or wrong in doing that, but man, I can relate to that. And the story of Esther has parallels to another story, the story of Daniel, which took place in the same kingdom 70 years previously. And Daniel was also a Jew in a foreign nation in a position of influence for such a time as this. But Daniel was open with his Jewish heritage and his beliefs. He was praying by an open window. He openly disobeyed the king's edicts, whereas Esther is more subversive, it seems. Both of them ultimately faced death for their resistance. And this challenges me. This challenges me. Today I find myself, for now at least, as a senior executive in a large organization. And I find it hard to know in any given moment when to stay quiet about my faith, like Esther, or to openly declare it from the rooftops, like Daniel. The Bible doesn't prescribe and it doesn't give me a playbook. I wish it did, but it doesn't. Let me give you an example, and it's an example of where I think I failed. So a year or so ago, during Mental Health Week in New Zealand, I had the opportunity to give a presentation to my company about my struggles with mental health. It's an issue that's important to me. I've struggled with depression over the years. And it was just an opportunity to tell my story, to make this conversation real so that other people felt they could talk about their issues as well, and also to talk about some tools and tactics for how to deal with depression and how to manage it. And when I was preparing for this presentation, which was going out online, and anybody in the company across New Zealand could join it, I thought about talking about my faith in that, because it's significant. It's the most significant thing. If God wasn't there, I might not even be here today, put it that way. But I didn't, and I chose not to, and I chose to talk about the practical things instead. And even in the Q&A afterwards, somebody asked me a question, which was pretty much opening the door for me to go, well, actually, I believe X, Y, and Z, and if God hadn't have saved me, then I might not be here today. But I didn't, and I chose not to. And I regret that today, and I was probably being overly conscious of my position in my organization and how that might be perceived. Second-guessing probably isn't the best thing to do, but I might handle it differently in the future. But then I think about all the times that God has given me people in my team who are going through major life events, which seems to happen so often, bereavements or sicknesses or major shocks. And I think my role is to provide a place of stability for them. This is the ongoing influence piece. And if I can be a good boss, and if their work is a safe place, then at least I'm not adding to their misery. And maybe I'm helping them to have something that's secure and stable in their life. And there's even been those rare moments where I have been able to pray with people in the office. Don't despise the small things. Faithfully seek God as part of your normal routine, and he will guide you with what to say in the moment. Later on in Matthew 10, that passage finishes with these words. Jesus says, "When you're brought before kings, don't be anxious how you are to speak or what you are to say, for what you are to say will be given to you in that hour." The words will be given to you in the moment when you step up. I wonder if that's how it was with Esther. She stepped up, not knowing exactly what she was going to say in that moment. But the right words were given to her to achieve God's purposes in the story. And there'll be situations in your life when it is right to take risks and situations when it isn't. God puts us in roles and positions and places, and we may not know why. Stay faithful. There may be one opportunity for you to speak to authority from your position, and it takes wisdom. All you can do is be faithful and keep your eyes on the Lord. Last week, Steve Maynor came to speak to us, and he quoted this verse. "Your ears shall hear a word behind you saying, 'This is the way, walk in it,' when you turn to the right or when you turn to the left." And a few weeks previously, Brad Carr shared with us, and he said, "If God has placed you in that job, that place, then you are not enough, but God is. So seek his guidance and then act." So that's the first half of the story. That's Esther and the way she handled her position of influence. We're going to pick up the story now in the second half from verse 9 of the chapter with Haman. And we'll just pick it up from verse 9 and take it from there. "And Haman went out that day, joyful and glad of heart," because he just finished a feast, remember? "But when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gates, that he neither rose nor trembled before him, he was filled with wrath against Mordecai. Nevertheless, Haman restrained himself and went home, and he sent and brought his friends and his wife Zeresh. And Haman recounted to them all the splendor of his riches, the number of his sons, all the promotions with which the king had honored him, and how he had advanced him above the officials and the servants of the king. Then Haman said, 'Even Queen Esther, let no one but me come with the king to the feast she prepared. And tomorrow also I am invited by her together with the king. Yet all this is worth nothing to me, so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate.' Then his wife Zeresh and all his friends said to him, 'Let a gallows 50 cubits high be made, and in the morning tell the king to have Mordecai hanged upon it. Then go joyfully with the king to the feast.' This idea pleased Haman, and he had the gallows made." So here we have Haman, the baddie in the story. also in a position of influence with the king, apparently much safer than Esther. But he handles his position of influence completely differently to Esther. He thinks he's safe. He's on the inside pulling the strings. He says, even the queen invited just me and the king to be with her at the feast. And if you follow the story to this point, he's been manipulating the king all along. He's pleased with his political maneuverings. Oh, how clever he thinks he is that he's got this position for himself. And oh, how weak and think we're in control when things are going well. But in this passage, we also see Haman's insecurity. Oh, how he rages. He's not satisfied with his power. How entitled and arrogant he is. When he sees Mordecai not bowing down to him, he rages against him. He feels the need to enforce his position, huffing and puffing to protect where he is. And how childish he seems to me compared to Esther's composure and grace. But then again, if you think you created your position of power, you will think you need to fight hard to hold on to it. That's actually a position of insecurity. Do you ever feel that insecurity in your lives? Or can you let it go and trust that God has you? Don't worry when others are raised up above you or you are overlooked. Trust in the providence of God that you are in the right place and do what he has put before you. He is good and he is for you. And the other fascinating thing I think about this is, see what Haman does with when he's raged and all angry about Mordecai. He calms himself, but then he goes and gathers people around him. Do you notice? So he goes out and he seeks his family and he seeks his friends. He seeks all his yes people, his sycophants, and he tells them how powerful he is. And look at my riches, look at my sons, haven't I done great for myself? And they go, oh yes, Haman, you're great, you're wonderful. You've done a fantastic job, you deserve this. You have been so successful, these are your rights. And in fact, his wife says, why don't you just go and see to it that Mordecai, who dared to go against your will, well, go and see to it that he's killed, because you deserve this. This is your right. Grab the honor for yourself that's rightly yours. What a proud attitude. And pride comes before a fall, which is a saying that comes from the Bible. You can find it in Proverbs 16. So my challenge for you is, when things go well for you, how do you respond? When you have enough money, when your family is all healthy, when you've got a promotion and you're treated with honor, you've got your health, you've got everything you need, how do you respond? Because I know when things go well for me, that's when I'm in the greatest danger. That's when I switch off my spiritual habits and I forget about God and I start to think, oh yeah, I earned this. Well, I know that I didn't. It's all grace. There's a famous verse in Philippians 4, which you've probably seen. Oh, skip that. There's a famous verse in Philippians 4, which you've probably seen on a bumper sticker or a Christian bookmark. And it says, I can do all things through him who strengthens me. So Paul is writing to the church in Philippi, and he's saying, I can do all things through God who strengthens me. And it's a wonderful promise and statement of faith. Excuse me. It's a wonderful promise and statement of faith. But the context is really important. And the previous verses say this. Paul says, I have learned in whatever situation I am to be content. I know how to be brought low, and I know how to abound. In any and every circumstance, I have learned the secret of facing plenty and hunger, abundance and need. I can do all things through him who strengthens me. So when Paul's saying I can do all things, what he means is I can endure poverty and I can endure success through God who gives me strength. I am content in both. Through God who gives me strength. I know hunger, but I can know plenty through God who gives me strength. Because in all those situations, God is in control. And it's not because of my cleverness that I've got to this position of influence. And if there's one verse that summarizes for me the different attitudes of Esther and Haman in chapter 5, it's this, which is so good, it's in the Bible twice. God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. And I think in chapter 5 of Esther, you see Esther have with this attitude of humility, seeking God, then daring to step out, showing humility to King Xerxes, and receiving grace and favor from God and from the king as a result. And by contrast, you have Haman with his proud, arrogant attitude, building himself up, trying to protect this position for himself in pride. And the Bible said that God will oppose him. And there's no middle ground here. It's not God's with you or he's neutral. It's God with you, God's with you, or God is opposing you. Imagine what that's like to have God opposing you. And what that means for this story, which we'll see in the coming weeks, God opposing Haman means God turns Haman's very plans against him in order to achieve his purposes. So Haman thinks he's so clever, but God's going to take those plans and use them against Haman. My favorite verse in the whole chapter, chapter 5, is the last one. The last verse is basically Haman going out to build gallows. That's how the chapter ends. And whoever put the chapter division here in Esther deserves a raise, because that is awesome. What a great cliffhanger. The irony is delicious, and it's so juicy, I actually can't resist jumping on it this morning, with apologies to preachers who are coming afterwards. But the irony is so delicious. This is the final set piece in this narrative. The stage is now set for everything that's going to come. And this word has come up before in Esther. It might be translated in your Bible as a stake instead of gallows. The word can mean both things, but it is the tool of execution, and Haman has built it to kill Mordecai. The delicious irony here, and I don't think this is a spoiler either, like Lord of the Rings, Haman will be hung on the very gallows he has built. And you'll have to come back to see how that plays out. He will be hoisted by his own petard. And the foreshadowing here is wonderful, but it's not just foreshadowing within Esther. This is foreshadowing to the New Testament in the providence of God. You see, that word which is translated gallows or stake literally means a wooden beam. And what does that remind us of? The cross of Christ 500 years later. The moment when Satan sought to kill Jesus by entering into Judas to betray him. The moment when Jesus was arrested and ultimately crucified on the cross on the wooden beam, on a wooden stake in the ground. But in that exact moment, death was defeated. The price for our sins was paid on the cross. The only thing that Satan could hold against us was that we broke God's law and deserved death. But the punishment has been served by Jesus, and I am free. And you are free. Satan has hung himself on the cross. He tried to kill Jesus, but he ended up killing himself. Hoisted by his own petard. In his very moment of victory, he was defeated. And at the cross, that was the very turning point of history when the tide has turned. Because Jesus has come to us now, the enemy is defeated. His final weapon was death, which has been neutralized. Death has no power over us, if you are in Christ. The end has been changed because Jesus came. The outcome is inevitable because Jesus came. It's just a matter of time. And for you, it all hangs on this. What will you do with Jesus this morning? That's the only thing that matters. The end will happen. The characters in the story, we've just got to play it out. And the only thing that matters is what you will do with Jesus. But the good news is, because Jesus died, if you accept his death for you, we have God's favor. And we can approach the throne of the King of the universe, holy and acceptable in his sight. And this is so powerfully played out for us in the story of Esther. Because of Jesus, when we enter God's court, the king's face brightens. He clothes us with royal robes like Esther. He is pleased with us and he bids us to come close. He lifts his scepter to pardon us and he welcomes us into the majesty of his throne room, filled with the glory of his presence. His scepter is held out to you in welcome today. Would you reach out and accept it? And our God is not a fickle God like King Xerxes. He's not prone to sudden mood swings. He will never cast us out on a whim. We aren't at risk of death because the death has been paid by his son Jesus. So unlike Esther, you don't need to play games with God. Just come as you are. You're accepted just as you are if you accept Christ. With all of your imperfections, your weaknesses, your desires, your hopes, your fears, you can trust him. Hebrews 4 says, "Let us then with confidence draw near to the throne of grace that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need because of Jesus." The tide has turned and our salvation is inevitable because of Jesus. If I get the band back up, that'd be great. And just as we go into this last song, I just got a couple of questions for you. I'd encourage you to stand, actually. Let's stand. And as we start singing the final song this morning, I just want you to open your hands to receive from God. And there's two questions for you. The first one is there something in your workplace that you need to stand up for? Is this the moment where you do actually need to stand up and count yourself as a Christian? And you do actually need to speak up for something? Maybe it's to share the gospel with a colleague, one of those people around you who are open to your influence. In which case, I'd encourage you to seek God now, seek him in prayer, maybe fast in the week, and then act, knowing that God will give you the words to say in the moment. And just lift that situation to God now. And the second question is, maybe you haven't accepted the gift of Jesus yourself before. Let me tell you, specifically, you are accepted by the King if you accept Jesus. The King of the universe is holding out his scepter to you right now, and he sees you just as you are completely, and he's smiling. Do you believe that he sent his son for you? Will you accept him? And I encourage you to reach out to him now as we sing this last song. Thank you.